Nick, for organizing this wonderful gathering of people from Australia and all over the world. Some of the otherworldly ones I know quite well. I'm delighted to see them again. I didn't realize that the first opportunity to see some colleagues from the Ngegrafa board will be in Australia, but that's great. And thank you for giving us the opportunity of joining you here and learning from you and meeting some of your colleagues and friends and indeed your disciples. Are we on? Okay.
It's a radio trick.
A radio trick. Need a radio man to tell a print person how to speak properly. And it's wonderful to be in Australia again. This is not my first time here. I've been here a couple of times before, all too briefly previously, but this one has been a slightly longer trip, so I'm very happy to have a chance to be here. Australia is, as Australians don't need to be reminded, but some of us need to be reminded, a multi-ethnic, multicultural society. You are always meeting people who are second-generation Australians or first-generation Australians, and they speak with funny accents, rather like my accent is funny. It's very amusing to hear Czech Australian or Italian Australian or Filipino Australian, or as I heard this afternoon from Randall Budd, Brooklyn Australian, which is a unique concoction. And the reminder of how multi-ethnic and multicultural Australia is a reminder in many ways of the constant interflux of the world in which we live and act as reporters. I was very privileged for 23 years as a magazine reporter in the U.S. Most of the time, actually, I was not in the U.S. I was overseas, and I was a foreign correspondent, and I had the good fortune to report from almost as many countries as Julia Bicknell has, about 55 in all. And when you report from many different countries, you sort of begin to pick a few things up, not just about the society in which you're reporting, but in some ways, generalizations about human behavior, some of which is surprising, some of which is not at all surprising. But I also learned in my travels around the world some delightful dialects. Like when I was covering news in Eastern Europe, I got to hear some of the terrific East German and Czech and Hungarian sardonic humor, of which I will give you one example now. Question: why do Czechoslovak policemen always go round in threes? Well, one can read and the other can write. And what about the third? He watches after those two intellectuals. But you know, the generalizations you get from being in Eastern Europe or China or the Middle East generally boil down, I think, to three aspirations, if I can be so bold as to make this generalization. After people have gotten food in their bellies and a shirt on their back and a roof over their head, they generally want, in varying proportions at different stages of society and their own careers, they want three things. They want to be free. They don't want people telling them what to do. They want justice, whatever the situation is, and they want truth. Now, sometimes these proportions vary. For example, in the American South, during the civil rights movement of the early 1960s, African Americans were campaigning for freedom. But in fact, what they really wanted was justice. They really wanted a redressal of gross injustices that they'd experienced. And in terms of the ability to express their protest, they were fighting for the freedom to do so against often very repressive regimes. I remember one of the earliest events, I guess this is dating me considerably, Nick may be the only person who remembers this, that I remember watching as a television viewer, but with a view to what it might be like to report this. When the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact allies invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968, I remember a remarkable BBC piece of footage where there was a Czechoslovak woman holding a sheet out of the window in Russian, which I happened to understand at that time. I still do a bit. which said, "Soldiers, your newspapers do not tell the truth." Now, this was absolutely amazing that all of the Russian soldiers in the tanks going past the lady, going through that village and past the home with the lady holding the sheet out, would have seen that. And they would have thought, well, what is she saying? What should we know and what should we consider the truth in this situation? And it wasn't until a little later that I made the acquaintance of a Soviet defector in the United States in the graduate school where I was, who had defected from the Soviet Union to Sweden, and then he came to the United States. And I remember him speaking to a group of American students who, in the late 60s, were generally very radical, and they thought everything possibly wrong with the world had probably started in the United States, and I guess some of them still think that way. But they asked him, why did you defect? What was it that caused you to want to leave the Soviet Union? And he said, you know, we had a newspaper in the Soviet Union, in Moscow, called Pravda. And Pravda means truth. But I very quickly discovered as a young man that virtually everything written in Pravda was the opposite of the truth. So I began to put two and two together and to question whether there might be something profoundly wrong with the system that had a government newspaper or Communist Party newspaper called Pravda, which means truth, but which was regularly telling people untruth about their own society and about the world. And that remained in my mind because I thought most of those American students had never confronted or never been confronted by a person who had to make very primary choices over an issue that some might consider abstract, namely the question of truth. I was in Belarus, jumping ahead a bit, in 2001. This was about 3 years after we started GEGRAFER, our Fellowship of Journalists, International Journalists. And I was the only foreigner at a conference of Christians in journalism from Belarus, from Russia, and from Ukraine. And they were sort of getting together for the first time, and we wanted to encourage them, so I was there. And because I was the only foreigner, they turned to me as though I knew the answer, and they said, David, what do you think journalism is? Which is an extraordinarily difficult question to answer. I mean, to answer coherently. But I thought about it a bit, and I said, I think journalism, which I've never studied as a subject, so I don't have an academic definition of it, but I think journalism is trying to find out what happened or what somebody said and reporting it as truthfully as one can and perhaps even analyzing why you think it might have happened. And they thought about that, and they thought, well, you know, that's not a bad definition. Let's go with that for a little bit longer. But I was really brought to a halt a little earlier than that. Actually, in China, 10 years earlier, in 1989, during the student demonstrations in Tiananmen Square and the Chinese army crackdown, of which I was privileged to have been an eyewitness. And very few foreigners were left in China. Most of them had evacuated with embassy staff and so on, and the only people left were us hacks and photographers and the military attachés of various Western embassies who sat on the rooftops of embassies listening to the crackle of Chinese radio, military radio communications, and report what was going on to their governments. But I remember wandering around the streets of Beijing on the morning after the massacre had happened. And because there were so few foreigners, some Chinese were just startled to see somebody from out of town who was there. And I remember an amazing encounter with a very grizzled old Chinese. And Chinese are very polite people, and they don't generally approach those to whom they have not been introduced, much less say anything unrequested. But this old Chinese gentleman came up to me, and he grabbed me by the lapels, and he said, "Thank you, thank you." I said, "What for? What have I done?" He said, "Thank you for staying with us. Thank you for telling the world what the Chinese government is doing to the Chinese people." And I thought about that. I thought, I had never considered journalism a profession with an especially high moral content, and there are, as you all know, there are very good reasons for that. But then I suddenly thought that this Chinese was grateful for the fact that some people in his capital city were willing and indeed able, permitted, to write the truth. And I realized at that time that to this old gentleman, truth was an extremely important quality. It was intimately related to justice, and indeed it was intimately related to freedom. And I thought more about that, especially when I was on another journalistic assignment 10 years later, this time not in China but on the West Bank. And I was doing a television documentary, which the BBC later ran, and I was interviewing, we were interviewing a Palestinian legislator who rather bravely focused on human rights issues. And he wasn't very popular, as one might understand, with the Palestinian authorities. And as we were beginning to set up the cameras and so on, there was a young woman in the room who was sort of helping him, who was clad in from head to toe in Islamic formal garb. So to my eyes, she looked like an Islamic fundamentalist, a radical, maybe. I didn't know what she was. In fact, she was so conservative, using the term in a sort of polite way, in Islamic attitudes, that she wouldn't actually shake hands with a member of the opposite sex who was not related to her. She was very conservative. But nevertheless, we got talking to her, and I realized something very profound. As she began to talk, and she began to ask us questions about what we did as journalists and so on, it became very clear that she was a journalist through and through. She would say things like, "Well, when I do some reporting, I never believe the first thing that people tell me. I always want to investigate whether somebody really said something or whether something really happened. And I check it out. And I always try to get alternative sources on things." And I thought, did this woman ever go to journalism school? No, she didn't. We asked her a few more questions. And then finally she said something that really thrilled me. She, as a journalist, she said, "You know, a lot of people think I'm a bit rebellious." And I thought, this is incredible. Here is a person who has been brought up in a completely non-Christian religious tradition, philosophical tradition, but who is passionate about truth. So there must be something about truth that is inherently attractive. And I am absolutely convinced that there is, and that this is the chief reason in any culture, in any country, that one should be a journalist. People the world over recognize truth when they hear it or see it. And people the world over are deeply offended by what they know to be lies. There is something inherently distasteful about somebody speaking to you, and this is applicable in all countries, whom you know to be lying. And I thought, well, why is that? Well, what is it about lies that's so offensive to the human intellect? And, of course, I got the answer from the gospel. We know that Jesus, in John chapter 14, says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And we've heard that so many times, it's gone in one ear and out the other, and we haven't really thought about it. But if you look four chapters later, in the same book in the Bible, in John's gospel, you have a very interesting conversation between Jesus and Pontius Pilate. I've thought about this a little bit because the name of our international journalism fellowship is called Gegrifa, and I think we are the only global organization that has a name derived from a quotation by Pontius Pilate, so it's something I've thought about. Jesus, as you will remember in chapter 18, is brought before Pilate after having first been taken to the Jewish leaders and so on. And the first question that Pilate asks him is, are you the king of the Jews? Now, you may wonder, well, what difference does it make to a Roman administrator responsible for law and order in this heaven-forsaken backwoods of the Roman Empire to ask what a particular Jewish rabbi is saying about himself? But there is Pilate asking the question of Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? In fact, you can almost imagine him like a sort of investigative reporter. He's got a microphone in one hand, and he says, are you the king of the Jews? And then he comes back, and he speaks, and it goes back and forth. And Jesus replies, as you may remember, is that your own idea, or did other people talk to you about me? And Pilate says, am I a Jew? Do you think I have any, you know, I'm paraphrasing now, why on earth should I care whether you are or you are not, what that? And Jesus replies, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews, but now my kingdom is from another place. So he's actually, that's three sentences by Jesus. And Pilate's only response is, you are a king. That's all he wants to find out. Is Jesus a king? So you are a king. And Jesus replies, you are right in saying I am a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. That's what Jesus says. Now think about that. What does it mean, everyone on the side of truth? I think it means people like that Islamic woman in the office in Nablus. I think it means the Chinese grizzled old gentleman in Beijing. I think it means the Czechoslovak woman holding a sheet out of her window so that Soviet tank drivers could see it. I think there is something inherent in the desire for truth. People desire justice, yes. People desire freedom. But people inexorably don't believe either of these two qualities can be obtained unless there is also truth. As journalists, the only product we can credibly deal with is truth. When journalists don't speak the truth, when they lie, when they exaggerate, when they misreport, they profoundly disappoint people. And why is that? Why do people, even in a very cynical age, expect journalists to speak the truth? Because it's the normal human experience that there is such a thing as truth. They may not believe it is Jesus, but they do believe somewhere out there, there is the truth about something or other. I know that postmodernists and multiculturalists and everybody else says there's no such thing as truth. Your truth is no different from, you know, is no better, no worse than my truth. That's a misuse of the word truth. If you ever meet a postmodernist whose car is hit in the back when he's stopped at a traffic light by another car, and he says, well, you say that you weren't going at all. I say you were going 20 miles an hour. Your truth is as good as mine. He doesn't say that. He's adamant. Everybody's adamant when things are really important in their lives about whether there is such a thing as truth or not. So people who come across journalists who are not telling the truth feel profoundly let down. And that brings us back to the point of what do we do as Christians about all this? Christians are often in the media filled with a sense of profound powerlessness. We say to ourselves, is anything we do in our profession going to make a real difference? And very often we have to come back and say, well, we don't really think so. We do our best, we report as well as we can, but we don't know if our reporting is going to have any major effect on anything or it is going to change anybody's mind. And I just want to remind you, for I think many of you who didn't know this, that the first reporters in the English language for daily newspapers were all Puritan Christians. Many of them had been expelled from their jobs by the government of King Charles I of England. And the first journalists who were writing the truth about the situation in England in the 1620s and 30s paid a very, very high price for telling the truth. Alexander Leighton in 1630 wrote an appeal to Parliament in which he said he felt the only authority that should be accepted above any other authority, including the authority of the king, was Scripture. The king didn't have any right to do anything that was against Scripture. For which statement he was whipped, his nose was slit, one side of his face was branded with a red-hot iron 1 week, and the other side was branded another week. In 1637, William Prynne, another Puritan journalist, was called to the Star Chamber, along with two others, for writing a pamphlet critical of the King of England, King Charles. For this great offence, his ears were cut off and his nose was slit. But in the 1640s, which was really the height of Puritanism in England and, of course, the parliamentary revolt against the king, journalism flourished in a most amazing way. One of the American newspapers, about the time of the American revolt against Britain, said the following. The Boston Gazette in the 1860s said, William Prynne, not lost his ears, King Charles would never have lost his head. And in the 1640s, the same time period, there were some absolutely marvelous examples of the kind of journalism that you and I think, should embrace with all our hearts. There was a newspaper called A Perfect Diurnal. It claimed to have all the news that was fit to print. And as Samuel Peck edited it, he was considered the father of English journalism. And a wonderful newspaper called the Parliament Scout that in 1643 had a reporter called John Billingham. And John Billingham pledged, quote, to tell the truth and not to quote a vapor or say such a one was routed, defeated, when actually there had been no battle. And truth was more important than which side you support. So Dillingham reported both when Cromwell's soldiers were pillaging the areas that they had conquered, and he reported when the royalists fought bravely against the Parliament. Now, this is astonishing, but it comes back to the present day, because truth is more important than Christianity, it's more important than the church, and it's more important than Christian reputation. Because truth is Jesus, and truth exists whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not, and truth is what sets us free. I received a phone call many years ago from a young journalism graduate from an American college who had gone to work for a newspaper which was reporting about the events of a very famous Christian ministry. The same Christian minister has been in the news recently with some rather unwise comments about a certain South American leader, which you won't mention his name. And the journalist, who was a Christian, had uncovered certain business dealings of this famous minister that were not terribly edifying. And he'd gone to his editor and he'd said, well, look, I've found out this and this and this. What should I do? And the editor had said, we'll do a series. Do the reporting on what you found. And he started writing, and the pieces were coming out on a sort of a weekly basis. And an amazing thing happened. Many of the members of this journalist's church came to him and they said, how dare you set your hand upon God's anointed one by publishing these horrifying investigative reports. Not the reports are wrong, but how dare you write what you are writing? How dare you defame this very august minister's reputation? And this happened so much that he called me up and he said, David, what do I do? This is this minister is not perfect, but he's done a lot of good things, and maybe these people have a point that I'm undermining the good that he does by bringing out the dirt that he is inadvertently, we hope, involved with. And I said to him, I said, Mark, you write the truth. The truth is always more important than reputation. Whether it's Christian reputation, it's more important than the church you belong to, and it's certainly more important than Christianity. Write the truth, and the truth will take care of everything else. And he did. And he got a promotion as a result, I'm glad to say. And not long after that, he was working for another newspaper. This is how God works, I think. And the other newspaper's editor, who was not a Christian, said to him, I want you to write a report on all the Christian communities in the world that are suffering extreme persecution. Take as much time as you need, contact as many experts as you can, but write a report on Christian persecution. Now, this was a secular editor asking him to do this. You know why? Because the secular editor trusted, knowing that this fellow was a Christian, that he would report the truth. He wouldn't protect people with whose views he happened to agree or whom he even admired. He would report the truth. And he wrote a wonderful series that actually won a prize for overseas reporting. Now, I want to come back to where we are, and I'll conclude with these comments. Christians, like all of us, are in churches that sometimes invite famous speakers, famous missionaries, famous evangelists, famous missionary doctors, famous missionary translators, and they tell all these wonderful stories of how they prayed and this and this and this happened. And many of us, I'm sure I'm speaking for myself, we tend to get a sort of inferiority complex. We say, well, I just work for an advertising agency, or maybe I'm a local newspaper reporter, or I'm a sort of drone bee in a big corporation that nobody really cares about. What role do I have in the Christian universe that could possibly be any value or importance? And here's my answer. Those of us who are journalists are dealing with one of the most precious human commodities that has ever been invented, the commodity of truth. You can't buy it, you can't sell it, it's completely free, and yet when it's properly expressed, it is invaluable. It can change lives, it can change nations, it certainly can change the universe in which you are in. And I want to say that if we focus on this, if we are close to truth, if we are on the side of truth, we cannot fail but to point people in the direction of Jesus, because that's what he said. Those who are on the side of truth, listen to me. Any time we dispel obscurity, lies, misinformation, misreporting, by unlocking just a chink extra of daylight in a dark place, we are, whether we realize it or not, pointing people to Jesus. And that's the most important, authentic Christian witness we can have in our professions. And it is not one that I think we should ever think dimly of or have an inferiority complex about. Because when it works properly, it changes everything. It changes the way people look at things, it changes the way people talk about things, and very often it leads indeed to justice and freedom as well. You can't define truth in any concrete way except in particular circumstances that you know. You can't give an overall definition of truth, but when you produce it, people recognize it. And even if you don't, on a day-to-day basis as a reporter, know quite how to grasp what the truth of a particular situation is, people also recognize if you are honestly striving to do so. They say to themselves, this person is not putting up with deflection or with sand thrown in his eyes or with lies. He is digging and digging and digging to find the truth. And that indeed is a very, very worthwhile occupation. During this weekend, we'll have a chance to hear from some very experienced journalists and some very high prelates of the Anglican Church. I congratulate Dominic for the impressive roster of speakers that he has acquired. But as you listen to them, I suggest to you that you ask yourself the question, how do these people in what they do relate to truth? How are they dealing with it? How are they interpreting it? How are they passing it on to us? How are they bringing light into our lives by letting us see it? And if you can come up with any kind of answer for the people you will hear speaking, you will be learning something. And I think we will all go away from here, enriched by the knowledge of how we can really bring light into the lives of people who consume what we report, whether they are politically satisfied or not, it really doesn't make any difference. But they will see in our efforts something that is coming close to the pursuit of truth. Thank you.
We've got some time for questions for David, if you want to put a question to him at this point.
Just in relation to the idea of truth and the fact that some countries don't welcome journalists, we're soon going to be travelling to a country where you're not allowed to go as a journalist, and we're going on a holiday visa.
I've done that.
Yeah, so I was talking about the question of truth. Like, if people are going to, if we were wanting to, use this as a vehicle for telling what's really happening in this country,
right?
And the border protection people are saying to us, "Why are you in this country? What are you going to do?
Right?
Do you have cameras? Blah blah blah."
Right.
Well,
that's a good question. Let me repeat the question. The question is, wanting to report about a country that doesn't allow journalists in and going on a tourist visa, and what happens if the fellow at the border says, "Do you have cameras? And, what are you doing when you're here?" Well, first of all, I would always carry with me an Instamatic camera or some very simple toy camera, one of those throwaway cameras, and say, "Yes, I have a camera," which is true. It's not the camera you use, but you have one. So you're not telling a lie, okay? You're very wise. I want to learn about your country. Okay? Why would anybody possibly object to that? Do you plan to write anything when you get back? I might. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that you can think through not lying, but not telling the whole truth. And I don't think that is disrespecting the Holy Spirit. I mean, one of the most interesting stories about the Scottish Covenanters was when the English soldiers arrested a woman who was going to a Covenanters meeting. The Covenanters were the sort of early Protestants in Scotland, and they were severely persecuted. And they wanted to know if she was going to a Covenanters meeting. So they said to her, "Where are you going?" And she said, "I am going to hear the will read of my elder brother." Well, her elder brother is Jesus. The will is what Jesus told his disciples. So she was completely truthful in what she said, but she used great wisdom. And of course, the English soldiers didn't understand what she was talking about, just said, "Well, it's a very sad event." So I think God, I wrote a book, Jesus in Beijing, and I entirely went on a tourist visa. I was never actually asked what I was doing. I was a tourist, and nobody ever said, "Are you here to report?" or something like that. So fortunately, it wasn't a problem. But I think there are a lot of ways to use wisdom without being entirely, without being dishonest about what you're doing. Yeah.
Have you got any examples on the top of your head of how, in telling the truth about a story, you've been able to point people to Christ?
Yeah. Have I been able to point people to Christ in telling a story, in telling the truth? I've been able to report situations where it might be expected that what I said would have been favorable to Christians because people know I'm a Christian, but I have said on occasion, "I don't think so-and-so is telling the truth," and that happens to be a Christian leader, or I think what is being done is unjust. And because people don't expect a Christian to speak critically of his own side, as it were, they are really amazed. What is the quality in a person that makes you willing to accept criticism for the sake of something higher? And well, the something higher is the truth. And I think that, you know, that doesn't directly point to Jesus, but I think it makes people think about what motivation a journalist might have. Yeah. Well, the question is similar to what the gentleman before you asked. How does it lead to Jesus? Well, it doesn't directly necessarily. It only leads because sometimes people may be puzzled by why you would report something that they don't think would come from your mouth, knowing what they do about you as a Christian or as a Westerner or whatever it is, but which they recognize to be truthful, and they would want to know the motivation for that. In a number of communist countries, I have said things to citizens that have been critical of my own society, and, you know, there are plenty of things to be critical about. And they have really been startled by that, because they have assumed that political loyalty supersedes all other loyalty. And I say to them, no, it doesn't. Truth, loyalty to truth, supersedes other loyalties. And they want to know why. And very often that leads to very interesting conversations about, you know, about faith. I remember a conversation with a Saudi Arabian government minister years ago, and he made some generalization about sort of Christian fundamentalists or something. And I said, well, you need to make a distinction between this and this and this. And he was startled, because he was willing to sort of think in cliches, and somebody had suggested to him that there are other ways of thinking which are actually more insightful. And that led to a very interesting conversation about faith, which he'd never had with any Christian before, or at least he said he hadn't. So I think by being somebody who really is zealous for truth, you are going to cause people to be interested in what motivates you. And that will lead them eventually to Jesus. Yeah. Right. Well, first of all, I think Christian journalists, I mean, I know that we're not always very successful at this, but a good journalist, and even if he or she is not necessarily a Christian, should try to be conscious of allowing his or her own prejudice to... not to get into the story. And that might involve a certain humility, a certain willingness to step back. And very often, one of the most disarming things is to say, I need to make a disclaimer at first. I am a member of such and such a church, and therefore it might be assumed that my attitude is this and this and this. You disarm the people in advance, and then you say, but... on the basis of various other factors, I think one could criticize so-and-so for behaving this way. You are being open about the possibilities of your worldview preclouding judgment, but you are generally disarming people by admitting them up front. Yes, sir.
How did you become a Christian, though?
I was an atheist at uni in England, and the short version of the story is an Anglican clergyman read to the Bible to me one evening about, well, he read the words of Jesus speaking to his disciples very intimately, and I can only say that in an instant I was convicted of the truth of Jesus Christ as the Son of God. And it was quite bewildering, because nobody had explained that this might actually happen when somebody reads the Bible to you. And I didn't want to be a Christian anyway. I didn't want to lead a Christian life. I was quite happy as a pagan. At least I thought I was. But that moment of confrontation, I think, with the Holy Spirit, and it just changed me over, you know, instantly. Yes, ma'am.
How does a journalist distinguish themselves as a truth teller in such a skeptical environment as we have these days, with information overload and such a discerning public?
Yeah, it's a very good question. How does a Christian distinguish himself in a society, in a community that's very skeptical of the existence of truth? I think you have to talk about things that everybody knows to be real. You have to relate what you were reporting to what is verifiably real life. And when people recognize that you are proclaiming real life to them, they will actually listen, or they will read what you say. You can't argue people into believing that there is such a thing as truth, or there is an absolute. I mean, nobody will pay any attention to you if you try to make a theoretical case. But when you point to something that's real, and then relate the experience of that to what you're reporting on or what you're encountering, people pay attention. There's no question. I mean, it's the human condition. We recognize reality when we see it. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good question. I think the best approach to a sort of skeptical colleague is to make fun of yourself. You know, you say, as you know, I'm a Christian, therefore I'm perfect. You know that they know that you're being that you're teasing them, and constantly to tease people about who you are, or to kind of not be frightened of mockery that may come up, but to make fun of the mockery itself. In other words, to join with other people having fun at your expense. And people are absolutely disarmed by that. I'm writing a book about Billy Graham, and one of the things I've discovered about Graham, which is quite well known, I think it's a secret, is that whenever he's been criticized, often by sort of very harsh sort of fundamentalists attacking him for associating with the wrong kinds of Christians, etc., he has responded in a way that sort of is very humorous and causes the other person to think. I'll give you one example. He's often been accused, you've set back the course of Christianity 50 years by preaching all this fundamentalist nonsense. And he replies, oh, I'm very disappointed. I wanted to set it back 1,900 years. So to have a sense of humor, a light touch, to be honest about your own frailty. I mean, we're all frail. Everybody in the human condition, people who are not Christian know that they make mistakes. They want to hear it from us. They kind of expect us to be goody two-shoes. And they're relieved to discover that we're not perfect. There was a bumper sticker a few years ago in the US which said, Christians are not perfect, just forgiven. And that there's something about dwelling on one's own frailty as an anchor to the reality of humanity which you see around you that's very heartwarming to skeptics. Skeptics like to hear that. Yes, last question.
David, Tula.
Well, the price I've had to pay for speaking the truth, well, I suppose I'm not the managing editor of Time magazine, nor the chief of correspondence, which I would dearly have loved to have been. I think I would have done a good job. I think I did pay a price. I think people did sort of think I was a little odd. A nice guy, but a little odd. I mean, with sort of rather peculiar beliefs. And I actually, some of this stuff I've only discovered years after leaving. People have sort of sidled up to me and kind of admitted what they thought, which is interesting. But I've never worried about that. I mean, I think as a journalist, you've got to take what I call the janitor test from the beginning. No matter how high up, actually the higher up the job is that you've got to say to yourself, if God told me to do so, I would become a janitor. Or whatever the lowliest occupation you can think of. And once you have that attitude, you're relaxed. If God wants to make me managing editor, terrific. If he doesn't, so what? I will do faithfully and diligently whatever my hand has to do. And I think that's the best that any of us can do at any time. We can't calculate what the impact of what we do and say and report will have on our own careers, and we shouldn't. And I think to one of the... I always try to say to journalists, especially young journalists starting off in the profession, relax, have fun. It's a fun profession. Enjoy it. I mean, it's stressful and tense and none of us has any time, but have fun. And when other people see that you're having fun, because generally speaking, they don't have fun, they want to know what makes you so light. And, you know, you may have a chance to sidle them away into a pub and tell them.